This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Well, if you went to the mall this weekend, you might have had trouble getting in and out of the parking lot. The day after Thanksgiving marks the official beginning of the holiday shopping season, and by now things are in full swing, which means jammed parking lots, mob sales racks, incessant jingle of Christmas and other holiday music. For retail stores, it's the busiest time of year, the season that could either make or break the entire budget for the year. It's also an important time for economists who look at the holiday shopping season to study consumer spending and consumer confidence and measure the overall health of the U.S. economy. Today on The State of Things, we're talking about our spending during the holiday season and the role of consumerism in our culture. Has holiday shopping gotten out of hand? Are you trying ever harder to keep it under control and finding it ever more difficult? Does our economy rely too much on how we spend at the mall? Or do you see the packed parking lots as a sign of economic health? We're taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Join us on our conversation today on holiday spending and consumerism in general, 877-962-9862. Joining me now is Joel Huber, a professor of marketing at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business. Joel, welcome.
Good to be here, Frank.
So what makes us spend? What's the trick to get us to part with our hard-earned dollar?
Well, I will talk about that. Before, I'd like to talk about some research we've done on the process by which people start spending. Uh-huh. We call it purchasing momentum. And the idea is that there's some inertia in purchasing. And I can probably show that best with an example. Suppose you're in a mall and there are many things you could be purchasing and you're looking at things and excited about things. You go into Bed and Bath and Beyond and you're still browsing. You're still thinking about things. And you see the perfect pillow for Aunt Polly, and you put it in the cart. At that point, according to our research, there's a switch that goes off. And the switch is you're now switching from browsing to purchasing. Mm. And we show that people purchase a great deal more. Some of that comes because it's economically justified to pool your purchases together and to just go through one checkout line. But the effects we find are much larger than that. And this has relevance in two respects. First, from the consumer end, it means you need to be much more vigilant about the time when you start purchasing, because our research says that once it starts, it's hard for you to stop. Mm. And you may well buy a number of things in that mode where you're not thinking very carefully.
So getting out of the car doesn't mean getting over the hump, which is that initial resistance to actually pulling out the wallet. But you're saying once you do, then the floodgates are open. Although your research does show that there are some purchases that are more likely to trigger this than others.
Yes. One of the more interesting parts of it is which purchases do and which do not trigger it. In particular, we find that if you buy something that could be considered a guilty pleasure. A guilty pleasure would be an ice cream cone. It could be an issue of Playboy. It could be a trash magazine. As soon as you do that, you're not actually likely to buy more. And we hypothesize that what is going on there is guilty pleasures are great, but you don't want to do them all the time. So as soon as that goes in, you're telling your body, close down. Let's not do this anymore.
We've gone too far already. So now our retailers must be aware of this vaguely.
Oh, they're very much aware
of
it. And retailers know that if they can get you started to buy, then you will buy more. And the whole notion of a loss leader, which are the items you come in and that are deeply discounted, those are the ones that get you to start buying. There's a trick to that. It can be too big a leader. Suppose in one study, we gave away the first item and had almost no effect. That people have to buy it, and if the discount is too deep, the next thing seems to be expensive relative to that discount.
Man, that's a lot of work these retailers have to go through.
They certainly do. In fact, retailers, I think, have the toughest job around because it is so easy for retailers to enter and leave the business. So if I want to know how to do things right, I actually go and look at existing and successful retailers, and it's amazing how well they do with this.
It sounds to me like the trick also is to get you to buy something that's fairly practical the first time.
That's right. You want to avoid when you first go in, you don't want to have a candy counter, or you don't want to have, as drugstores used to have, is a soda fountain. And people would go in and they'd have the ice cream or the soda, and then they'd leave. Because when they're having the ice cream or the soda, it turns off that purchasing momentum. It also, they aren't thinking about the fact that they need toothpaste or something for their own health, and so they're avoiding that. So,
or they may have just blown the wad. They don't have any money. There's nothing left for toothpaste.
Well, I think most people go beyond their wad. The best food example is Costco. Costco has food, but it's when you leave. And the reason they don't give it first is at Costco, you're often buying products which you eat. And it is well known that if you go in to buy food and on an empty stomach, you will buy more than if you go on a full stomach. So the last thing they want to do is fill you up before you buy food. So they give it to you as a reward at the end, but not at the beginning.
Well, so the jury is still out on how all of this purchasing affects us individually and whether or not it improves our lives. But it seems pretty clear that this is something important for the economy. As we talk today about the retail sector and holiday shopping, and joining me now is Mike Salemi. Mike is a professor of economics at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Mike, welcome.
Thank you, Frank. And hi, Joel. Good to see you again.
Mike.
So holiday shopping is very important to the retail sector, obviously. How important is it to the economy?
Well, holiday shopping is quite important. As a matter of fact, if you'd simply look at the data on retail sales, you'd see that they have this very, very interesting feature, and that is a spike every December, followed, by the way, by the negative spike in January. Right. And what that means is that other things equal, every December, retail sales are about 25% higher than they are in the average month of the year. So that's quite important.
Well, and in fact, is it really true that retailers are more or less operating in the red until this holiday season?
Well, I'm not sure about that, but I do know that the Christmas season, the holiday season, is a time when we get a real signal on just how confident the American consumer is in the future of the economy. This is a time when the holiday can be large or small, and it's a way in which the consumers indicate whether they think their near-term future justifies a big or a small holiday.
So they're looking at whether or not they expect to continue to have a job or have a job,
you
or
bet.
Whether they're going to get an increase or a better job. Well, what about the economy as a whole? Does this mean does spending on consumer goods, is that necessarily good for the economy?
Well, good can be thought of in a couple of ways. Let's just talk about keeping the economy going first and set aside questions about ethics and lifestyle. The trend in the U.S. economy has been that over the post-World War II period, consumption, which began at around 60% of our gross domestic product, is now right at 70%. So 7 out of every $10 that our nation absorbs is absorbed by the household on consumer goods. When the economy turns down, it's because consumption reinforces whatever bad news occurs. To get out of a recession and begin a healthy expansion where jobs are created requires consumers to buy in. Otherwise, it doesn't happen.
So the economy itself really depends on this kind of retail buying.
Without a doubt.
I want to take a little deeper look at this with and to illustrate this, we want to hear from President Bush. This was about 2 years ago as he was trying to sell the tax cut.
If people have more money to spend, it means somebody has got to produce more for them. And the producers then need to hire people. It's economics 101.
Economics 101, very simple concept in the mouth of President Bush. But I want to take us back because this may be the most naive question in the world, but you're an economist and you can't go anywhere. The door is locked. So the question is, I'm taking us back to a time when, you know, the dawn of humankind. And here's this tribe sitting around the fire. And I hear the chief telling the warriors, look, if we don't start eating more meat and burning more wood and wearing more skins, this economy, our whole society will collapse.
Frank, we want to go. We want to divide time pre-1776 and post-1776. Prior to the creation of urban environments and industrialization, the world was a place where people fought for their subsistence. In that place, in that more brutal world, families were lucky to be able to feed themselves, clothe themselves, and bring their children to maturity. However, as people began moving to the cities and began organizing a material society, an amazing thing happened that's produced tremendous opportunities for increased consumption and growth. And that was specialization. And I say 1776 because that's when Adam Smith first talked about it in The Wealth of Nations.
So we have this concept now that that by spending we can create jobs, create wealth, and go a little bit beyond subsistence living. But now I'll raise another economic principle, the point of diminishing returns. Have we become too dependent on this?
Well, economists believe that consumers are sovereign, that the study of economics is the study about how society organizes itself to give consumers what they want. And to an order of approximation, we think it's a good idea to assume that consumers understand themselves. And so when consumers will move away towards, say, less material consumption and more quality time, we believe the economy will give them that. And it is already.
Well, consumers certainly know what they want. Do they know what they want and what the effect will be in the future? And do they act as individuals or in combination as a society? These are the questions we'll probe as we take a look at the Christmas and holiday shopping season on the state of things, joined by Joel Huber, professor of marketing at Duke's Fuqua School of Business, and Mike Salemi, professor of economics at UNC Chapel Hill. We're taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacia. We're talking today about our urge to buy during the holiday season. Is this the time of year you've been waiting for or the time of year you dread? We're taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Joining us are Joel Huber, professor of marketing at Duke's Fuqua School of Business, and Mike Salemi's with us. He's a professor of economics at UNC Chapel Hill, and taking your calls at 877-962-9862. So before the break, we were talking economics 101, buy a lot, it stokes the economy, people work, and the economy gets stronger. But then there's the question of whether or not these goods are being produced here and where those dollars are actually going, Joel.
Yes, I'd particularly like to get Mike's view on the issue of many of the consumer goods and the durables that consumers purchase are ones which are not now
They're not being produced here.
Produced in this country. And because of that, we may be making worse the balance of payment. And so what we're doing now, even though it is driving the short-term economy, may be doing very bad things to the long-term. Mike?
I won't deny that for one second, Joel. I think you're dead bang on. Our trade deficits are at very high levels, historically speaking. And what they represent is an IOU that the rest of the world can cash when it sees fit. In the last few years, the world has been willing to hold our debt. They've been saying, we like these assets that the U.S. offers us, these bonds and such. But at some point, they'll have enough of that. And when they do, the dollars will come home and they will want real things. California wine, Chevys, and our own manufacturers. And if that happens too quickly, we're going to be in for a shock.
So the economics 101 breaks down to a certain extent if you're not producing the goods that you're selling, or at least may over time.
Well, let us say that the economics 101 can be delayed. There's a remove there. Right now, our spending is stimulating China's economy greatly. At some point, the Chinese will spend with someone, and when they do, we will get some stimulus. The problem will be whether this all happens so quickly that it's tough to adjust to. I'll give you one example of an adjustment that's happened already. I am not going to Paris anytime soon. I can't afford it. But I expect to hear a lot of French spoken at Disney World next time I'm there.
Mike, what about the savings rate? This has been an issue that as consumers spend more, they logically save less. In that context, should we be worried about that? And my sense of particularly Christmas spending is people spend themselves spend up to their savings and increase
well,
their
debt. Well, and beyond.
I
mean, that's a real serious question about whether or not consumer debt becomes a problem for the economy at large.
Well, I have two-part view about that. I don't think Christmas in and of itself does in Americans' saving. I think that to a large extent, a good bit of Christmas spending is reallocated from the rest of the year. So I don't think we'd find our best evidence about U.S. saving at Christmas. However, it is the case that while our consumption's risen, our savings has fallen, and we've been relying on the rest of the world to provide us funds to build capital, and that is not a long-term solution. So there, I think you're again square on.
I want to take this question from another perspective. We're talking about our drive to buy during the holiday season, whether this is a model of unfettered economic growth and whether or not that's good for our culture, society, good for our pocketbooks. We're joined now by Betsy Taylor. Betsy is president of the Center for a New American Dream. It's an organization that takes a look at some of the challenges and asks us to be perhaps more mindful about our consumer habits and suggesting alternatives. Betsy Taylor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What are some of the problems that you see with our sort of consumer and our buying habits?
Well, the list goes on and on. I mean, obviously what Joel and Mike are saying is true, that right now in many ways the global economy depends on our consumption. But let's break that down for what it means for the individual. Americans today are working longer hours than anybody else in the industrial world. So we've got to work really hard to get the money to do this buying. People are very stressed out. Let's look at whether the consumption is really making us happy. What is the quality of our lives? The center just did a poll released a couple months ago, and almost everyone, 93% of Americans, say that as a society we're just too focused on working and making money and not enough on family and community. So when you look at this sort of rat race life that we're in, the downsides are that we work very, very hard to get those big houses, those big cars, those big TVs. We do not have financial security. The savings rate, as I think it was Mike was pointing out, the savings rate is almost flat. We're almost saving nothing. It's kind of a buy now, pay later. Mm. And then the other part of this that we don't pay attention to either nationally or as individuals, is the environmental effect. And it's really fascinating. You hear the economists constantly talking about the need to increase consumer spending. If you listen to the scientists, they are screaming for us to slow consumption. Because what does it mean that we're stoking the Chinese economy? What it means with that 10% GDP is that one-third of the world's raw materials are being used by China. So, I mean, I could go on. And it doesn't mean that we have to be anti-consumer, but we have to begin looking at why are we here? What is life supposed to be about anyway? Is it supposed to be about spending time at the mall?
Well, I want to take your question, and I want to turn it a little bit and pose it to Mike Salemi and perhaps put words in your mouth. But as an economist, I would guess that you might say, look, you may have a poll that shows 88% of folks think we're spending too much. But the final poll is at those cash registers, and that suggests that consumers want to spend.
Well, Betsy and I could have a long conversation, and I will. I'll limit myself to two observations. First is the American people may decry their our current state of affairs, but most of them have choices, and they reveal that they prefer the one they're doing now. All of us. We could live a simpler lifestyle. We could drive a smaller car. We could work fewer hours. This nation is filled with opportunities. And when we begin matching our actions to those polls, this economy will provide what we want. My second observation is about China. I think that stimulating the Chinese economy is about one of the best things we can do, because we are going to build with them an interdependency that is going to keep them as our friend instead of being worried about them as our potential enemy. And too often we ignore that aspect of trade.
But Joel, if I take you back to that pre-1776 world where people were a little more prudent about their resources, aren't the laws of supply and demand going to catch up with us at some point if we keep using our resources and urging people to use ever more, you start running out, and doesn't the price go up at that point?
Frank, I'm old enough to remember the Club of Rome. The Club of Rome in the 1960s had a list of resources, all of which we were going to run out of, and none of which we've run out of yet. The economist believes in the power of the price. The price signals to people when something is scarce. Right now we're getting a signal that petroleum is pretty scarce, but boy, the last week the petroleum price dropped like a rock. Consumers are smart enough to figure out what prices tell them.
Betsy, let me get you to respond to that.
I'd love to.
Yeah. I mean, if we're so unhappy with our practices, why do we keep buying?
Well, I think, you know, this is the sort of neoclassical economics point of view. And there's just a lot of evidence that, in fact, people don't make these consumer choices in some sort of level playing field and in a vacuum. For example, we are encouraged to consume on a nonstop basis. We are certainly not encouraged to simplify on a nonstop basis. For example, Business Week says we get about 3,000 advertisements coming at us a day, encouraging us to be patriotic and spend, encouraging us to find happiness and spend. So it's not as though people are operating in an environment where they're not constantly bombarded with messages telling them to go out and buy. Now, when you look at the role of the economy and the role of price, for example, this whole idea that, well, price will guide us, price will fix things. From an environmental point of view, that just doesn't make sense. Price has not sent us the right signals for things like climate change, things like the complete collapse of fisheries. So while price does send some signals about what's going on in the world so that we'll conserve resources, in other ways it completely fails. So I guess we can argue on a macroeconomic basis or much more in terms of why are we here and what really matters. But on the macroeconomic basis, I really do think there needs to be not a polarization around this, but rather some serious engagement between the scientists and the economists about, in a finite world, whether the Club of Rome was right in its early predictions. In a finite world, we can't have an economy where 3 new McDonald's are opening every day, where 1 new Walmart opens every day. You can't do it. Eventually, things collapse, and in fact, they're collapsing.
Well, I want to ask Joel Huber a question from the marketing standpoint, because Betsy raises, I think, a good question here. Mike, you talked about Adam Smith and the Wealth of Nations, and he was assuming that he had a rational consumer, a rational buyer. But Joel, I think your research probably indicates that we're not very rational when it comes to buying.
Well, in the short run, we're certainly not very rational, and that is appropriate, although Mike is right on in saying that in the long run, people adapt. The issue I think before us is how strong the change is going to be in the next 4 to 5 years. And you could write a story that prices will go up, that wages will remain flat, that people will be less satisfied with the kind of work they do and the challenges as work becomes, in a sense, more efficient, it becomes less intriguing for people. And on the shopping end, you have people who spend a great deal of time and pleasure out of this process of shopping. You just need to go to the malls. You watch people. They're excited. They're up. This is fun. This is a game. This is something they do well. And those changes worry me from the perspective of what it will do to what it will do to people. I think it will move them, Betsy, towards your model, that people will eventually, and may take a generation, will get to a point of valuing material things less. Mm-hmm. But it will take a generation. In the meantime, I'm worried about the state of the consumer and the country as that occurs.
Well, Betsy, do you look at this as a matter of time? In other words, that it would take a generation, or does something have to happen to change our habits and bring them in line with what your polls seem to indicate?
Well, the polls show that a large number of Americans are choosing to make choices, as Mike points out, to actually consume less and to try to work part-time, for example, so that they have time with their kids. That means they make a little less money. That means they consume a little bit less. Maybe they downshift. So the polls actually suggest large numbers of people are trying to do that. It's hard to do that with a framed social safety net. So when you have to worry about the cost of rising housing and health care and retirement and Social Security and all of that, it's hard to stop working. And so there's an interplay here in a society where we're making choices to dramatically cut taxes, not to have public spending, which also fuels the economy, and to leave people sort of on their own. But there is a yearning in the American public. It's you know, we all know this. You just sit, you can talk to your wives, talk to your students. People are doing too much. They're going too fast. They're trying to get ahead. They're trying to stay ahead. Often that's a material thing. Sometimes that's just about trying to make it. And I do think that it's reaching a point where the signs of depression, the signs of stress-related diseases are getting to a point where many people are saying, hold it. I've had it. And this happened a lot, by the way, after September 11th, a real spike in the number of people trying to downshift. But your question, is it going to take a lifetime? Is it going to take a generation? From the macroeconomic perspective, I'm arguing, and this is almost heretical in American society, that scientists and economists and elected officials need to sit down around the same table and look at the large paradigm of a growth economy that says we must always maximize consumption and growth in order to maintain employment and prosperity in a finite world. It's, you know, the evidence is that that's going to have to be looked at, and I think changing that so that our economy can support life, support quality of living for everybody, and support a healthy environment, I think that will take a generation or more for us to go through those kinds of changes.
Mike Salemi?
Thank you, Frank. Betsy, I agree with a lot of what you're going to say and what you have said, but first of all, the problem with our environment isn't too many markets, it's too few. We don't have now a market for clean air. If we did, people would realize it's becoming scarce. But let's look at something that's closely related. There's now a market in pollution credits in the Ohio Valley. You want to put out sulfur dioxide, you have to pay for the right to do it. And this is a way in which we're efficiently caring for our environment. Also, we talk about choosing a life with more leisure and higher quality leisure. If you came to Chapel Hill, you would see that the market is producing more and more opportunities to do yoga here than ever before, and that the price that people charge and willingly pay for a session of yoga is increasing. I think that a market economy like we have is going to be part of the solution, and a planned economy would let us down every single time.
Well, I'd love to jump in for a second, if I could, Frank.
Sure.
But I don't, you know, this can become sort of couched in the traditional left-right frame, which I don't actually think is the solution. I don't think it's about social planning versus free market. I think those are old frames for having the discussion. No question, the market's going to be part of the solution, and no question, I love the fact that there's this, you know, eruption of yoga and all sorts of new emerging companies and industries, really. But to privatize everything, to think that the market will solve these problems, that the market will help people slow down, have time with their kids, feel safe, fix the fact that, you know, over half the coral reefs are gone.
Well, Betsy, let me just interrupt you for a minute, because you talked about, you know, scientists and economists getting together and, you know, reviewing this. What do you expect to come out of that?
Well, I think at the very first, you know, I really look at it like Galileo. And Galileo said, you know, there's a different way of looking at reality here. We're not the center of the universe. We're revolving around the sun. And, you know, he was put in jail for that. His readings were banned for 200 years. Well, today the scientists are saying we cannot keep consuming like this. And this has come out from the United Nations National Academy of Science, report after report. The growth and increased consumption combined with population are the number one root causes of our environmental problems. This has come out. And yet there's no engagement on this, because it's almost a religion to believe that the growth economy will fix everything, that free markets, it's become really a religion. And I think until we can transcend that conversation so that scientists and economists, and then we can say, okay, what kind of growth can we have?
Joel Huber?
Betsy, do you think that belief in the economic system and what I see is a love of shopping that occurs, do you think that is going to that's going to change quickly? Or it seems to me that that is imbued in the very fabric of our being, and it won't be an easy thing to change.
The love of shopping?
Yes.
I think we do have a need for novelty. I think that people have always had some of their identity come from material objects. I think material objects give pleasure and increase quality of life. So I'm not anti-consumption. I think it's a question of balance. What our polls show over and over, and so do Gallup polls and other polls, people are starving for time to be out in nature, to enjoy their families, to just hang out with friends, to pursue their hobbies, to go fishing down there in Raleigh, North Carolina. I went to Duke. You know, there's so many beautiful areas in North Carolina to be explored. People aren't out there. They're inside working. They're doing. So I think that people will always want to consume, and I think that they will also always want time with their families, time outside. And the question is, can we structure things?
Betsy, I wish I had more time on this program, but we don't. Betsy Taylor, president of the Center for a New American Dream, thank you very much. Mike Salemi, professor of economics at UNC Chapel Hill, and Joel Huber, professor of marketing at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business. Thank you both.
Good to
thank
be with you,
Frank.
You.
Thanks,
thank
Frank.
Just ahead, we open the book of the floating world on the state of things. Stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Around 1945, William J. Thompson, a young sculptor, was drafted into the United States military. He went to Japan as part of the occupying forces there during the end of World War II. He took along his camera. The result was an album of photographs depicting everything from the calm of the ocean shore to the ravaged Japanese countryside. In 1997, a few years after William Thompson died, his son John Thompson took the album from the shelf and began his own journey to Japan. After historical, cultural, and imaginative research, John Thompson, a professor of 20th century American English literature at North Carolina State University, published The Book of the Floating World, a collection of poems based on his father's photographs. And John Thompson joins us now. John, welcome.
Pleased to be here.
Your father was an artist and then drafted into the service. What did he do in Japan?
Well, he had a most unlikely set of occupations, according to family lore. He was an artist and a sculptor, so he was really put to work doing some unconventional things, drawing signs, modeling sort of instructive sculptures, things like that. They were just wholly utilitarian.
Instructive sculptures for the American, the occupation force?
That's right. That's right. Just all along the lines of helping people to get where they needed to be.
Yeah. And did you talk with him much growing up about that?
No. That was actually one of the interesting things about the project was that the album had been a sort of presence in my life, sort of in the background, but it wasn't until after he died that I really took a look at it and began to examine the photographs carefully. And I realized that, you know, that there was a whole other chapter to his life, as there really is to most people's lives, other than, you know, the person that I knew.
Why did you wait?
Why did I wait?
Or was it waiting? I mean, was it?
Well, it was just really fortuitous. I wasn't meaning to sort of wait. I just sort of came across it, as you say, several years after he died, and it really captured my imagination then. I hadn't really thought about it before that, and then I began to do some reading about World War II and Japan and the occupation, and it all eventually led to this book.
Take us through the process now. You look at the photograph and respond to it in poetry?
Yes. I was really interested in trying to write poems that would use the photographs as a point of departure rather than just be confined by the frame of the photograph. So when I was writing, I would try to really let the photograph resonate with its own historical moment as well as my own. So the poems that emerged, some are more directly about the photographs, but more often they tend not to be, and are interested in sort of connecting the past and the present.
The past and the present, and I guess what you had to imagine was your father's perception, your perception, and then your perception over time.
Exactly so. Exactly so. And I was really arrested by, you know, the whole question of the ethics of photography in that kind of context, in an occupation context, and then again the ethics of sort of writing about that now. So the particular genre that these poems belong to is called ekphrasis, and that's really poetry about art, and it's a fascinating genre because it allows you to sort of bring two dimensions together, the actual poem and then the actual work of art.
Will you read one for us?
Sure, I'd be happy to. This poem is called Hanganji Temple 2, and it's based on a photograph of the interior of a Hanganji temple in Tokyo, and the photograph, that is taken during a wedding. And you can barely see in the photograph the figures of the bride and the groom. Hanganji Temple 2. Let us not have words that stand for things. Let us not have things that stand for other things. Let us not let this nave stand for love or loss or departure. Let everything be as it was, whenever that was. Let the room be as it was, huge, drafty, and dim, yet full of the scent of incense and ceremony. Let everything stand for itself, be for itself, and the room and everything in it will not be the world, will not be the memory of desire, will not be the cry of desire, or just the cry echoing in the space of desire. Whatever it was, it had something to do with the echoes of words, something to do with the silence after them, and who they were.
I'm glad you chose that poem, because throughout, it seemed to me a theme that struck me was this business of the space in between, the emptiness, and the way time cascades. And overall, I got the sense that there was this look at how we mediate, how mediation of history, of experience, using words, not using words, has a way of falsifying and distorting the way.
Yes. Well, the poem is sort of interested in picking up with that paradox. You know, how do you write about things that are distant? And so rather than trying to provide a kind of authoritative answer for that, I instead tried to integrate the problem of writing about things that are so distant, things that are only partly known and in many cases wholly imagined. All of the poetry here is really, I think, trying to engage that paradox of dealing with a past that is gone, dealing with voices that are gone, and yet at the same time, the trace of that is so powerful and still remains.
Yeah. You do, in the Black Market, for instance, there's a photo taken from a distance, and maybe I'll have you read some of it, but I want to just set it up a bit. There's this sense of real confusion. I mean, if you look from afar, it's confused, it's aimless, but then there are details, and you begin to focus on that, and people sort of reconstructing their lives. But, you know, what does the picture show? Is it the chaos of a post-war world trying to pull itself together, or do we see the sort of the pluck and courage of people who are determined to do just that?
Well, I think you see both in the photographs, or at least that's what I saw in the photographs. Ruin, devastation, catastrophe, And yet at the same time, one of the things that emerged in my own reading about this period is that the Japanese people weren't certainly a monolith, nor are we. And so I tried to keep that sense of both nation and individuality on the part of the Japanese and on our part as well. Certainly World War II was a clash of nations, but certainly it was also a clash of individuals. And what really fascinated me about these photographs was the fate of the individual, if I might call it that. Individuals going about their ordinary everyday life and sort of caught in particular moments and just trying to get by and trying to move on. I really found that tremendously affecting.
So you found out a little bit more about the history of that period and of Japan. Did you find out any more about your father as a result?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know. I think I did. I think that I learned that, you know, a person that you even know very well has other dimensions to him. Again, the poems, you know, really try to integrate into their very being, as it were, the realization that we half create what we see, to sort of quote Wordsworth. We make of the world, you know, a great deal, everything really.
Well, I wonder if you had intended also. Did you see this as a way of knowing more about your father?
Yeah, it's a very elegiac project. The poems, I think, really have that, or at least I hope they have that kind of undertow, the undertow of loss and mourning, but also, you know, the sense that just as a time doesn't die, I think neither do individuals entirely. There's always the trace of those presences that persist, and so I hope that the poetry has that kind of balance between absence and presence and loss and continuity.
John Thompson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Thompson is professor of English at North Carolina State University. His new book of poems is called The Book of the Floating World. He'll be reading from the book at Quail Ridge Bookstore in Raleigh on Sunday, January 9th. Those are the sounds of the Branchettes, a North Carolina-based gospel group that performed all over the world for more than 20 years. One of the founding members of the Branchettes, Sister Ethel Elliott, died last week. She was 76. Joe Newberry of North Carolina Arts Council joins us now. Welcome back, Joe.
Thank you.
You attended the memorial service for Sister Ethel this past weekend. Tell us about that.
Oh, Lord. Driving up, we wondered, do we have the right place? And we saw about 200 cars.
Wow.
And walked into it was a cavernous church for a Disciples of Christ church in Newton Grove, North Carolina. And there was beautiful music by a group called the Jerusalem Travelers. And the folks got up and spoke about Sister Ethel and talked about how fun she was and how funny she was and what an amazing person she was.
Well, we should back up a bit and just talk a little about the Branchettes. Who are they?
Branchettes formed, it's getting up almost 30 years ago. They formed sort of by happenstance. They were supposed to have a singing with a bunch of folks, and Sister Lena May Perry and Sister Ethel Elliott and Sister Perry's sister showed up, and they were the only three. And so they said, well, I guess we better go ahead and sing. And when they did, people started falling out. And so the thing I love about the Branchettes is no matter what the venue, the content always stayed the same.
And where does their place in the history of North Carolina music?
They according to Glenn Henson, who is a professor at UNC, he's done a lot of research and worked with the Branchettes a lot. And their repertoire is more in the congregational hymn singing of earlier generations of African Americans. And so gospel music over the years has sort of slicked up and been the Branchettes were all about the message.
They stayed pure. And there was a bit of a controversy within the world of gospel about whether or not you can make it popular or whether you had to stick with the word and be more spiritual.
I think we'll have to leave that to gospel scholars. What I can tell you is that a couple of years ago, Pinecone, the Piedmont Council of Traditional Music, took the Branchettes over to Omagh, Northern Ireland. They were the first African-American performers at the annual Labor Day Festival in Omagh. And the Branchettes filled a church in Omagh. And people spilled out on the sidewalk to hear. And the word from the folks listening was, we can hear them and there's no sound system.
True testament to the form itself and to the group. Tell us about Sister Ethel in particular, born near Benson in Johnston County.
Rural Johnston County. And she grew up in a family and a church that encouraged singing. And she said that she learned to sing from her stepmother. And so by the time she was in high school, she'd formed a gospel group with her sister and brother and a friend. And she said in an interview that at Bentonville Disciple Church, we had one of the best and hottest junior choirs in Johnston County.
What was her role in the group itself?
She was the person in the group that would make sure that the dresses were pressed, that everybody showed up on time, that they were ready to go.
So she was the manager and a vocalist.
She was a driving force, yeah. And that was what came out of the service on Saturday night down in Newton Grove, is that this was an amazing woman, and not only for her singing, but for the role in her community, the role in her church, and the role in North Carolina. And that's one of the reasons why the Branchettes were given the North Carolina Folk Heritage Award in 1995.
Well, we should probably listen to some of that music. Joel, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Joe Newberry is a member of the North Carolina Arts Council, and we leave you with more of the Branchettes, Lena Mae Perry and her sister Ethel Elliott.
Steal away, steal away to Jesus. Steal away, steal away home. I ain't got long to stay here. My Lord, he calls.
That's the state of things for today. Support for the state of things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Frank Stachow. Our thanks to Glenn Hinson from the UNC Chapel Hill Anthropology and Folklore Department for his help in providing the music from the Branchettes.
Within my soul, I ain't got long to stay here. Steal away, steal away, steal away to Jesus. Steal away, steal away home. I ain't got long to stay.